Welcome to the New Zealand Post Writers and Readers Week. We have with us this afternoon a stellar lineup of the scientifically inclined. It's a very exciting genre, it seems to me, that's emerged in nonfiction, specifically New Zealand nonfiction in recent times, and it's that of science for the lay person. It seems to me that it's not an easy thing to do, write an engaging book that manages to explain complicated things to the non-expert without dumbing down. And the three authors that we have with us today have done a brilliant job of just that. Zoologist and filmmaker Lloyd Spencer Davis has written a funny and beautiful book about the man he reckons did more to change the way we think about ourselves since Jesus, Charles Darwin. Now, Darwin's interests were wide-ranging, although they didn't include penguins, as Lloyd, who is a penguin lover in a good way, sadly observes. Geology was something Darwin was into, and if only he'd known what Hamish Campbell knows now, we might have got the origin of species a lot sooner. Hamish is a geologist, and his book, In Search of Ancient New Zealand, breathes fresh life into, well, so-called inanimate rocks. They turn out, of course, to be quite animated indeed. And meanwhile, Bernard Beckett roams like a voracious omnivore over the fields of science and philosophy, investigating whether science can make meaning of our lives. As a fiction writer, he has an attachment to story, and one of his big questions is whether science and story can coexist. Next year is, of course, 150 years since Darwin published On the Origin of Species, so we'd better get in before the rush of merchandise. And the T-shirts, all these three books have him in common in various ways. I wanted to ask you, Lloyd, first of all, why you think Darwin was so important, given that he was quite tentative, actually.
Well, he was tentative in that he took a while to put his theories out there. But I think he is important because his ideas about evolution and how we came into being stack up, and they were so fundamentally different from the prevailing view of the times.
But lots of other people had those same ideas. I mean, Erasmus, his grandfather, was talking about evolution, you know, before Alfred, Alfred Russell Wallace.
Indeed. It's one thing to say, look at a monkey and say, I look like a monkey. It's another thing to come up with a mechanism that can show you how you can go from the ancestors of monkeys to humans or whatever else. And that's what Darwin did. He gave us a mechanism.
So not only what, but how.
Exactly.
But he didn't know about DNA. So what did he think was going on?
Well, he basically used the idea that it was variation. He didn't understand about genes, because he didn't even know about Mendel, who was a contemporary of his. What he understood was that animals have particular traits, and those traits are heritable, and by some sort of dint of competition and so forth, you get better traits persisting in the population, because the animals with those traits, they survive better and they breed more.
Mm. One of the things, Bernard, that I think attaches you to the idea of evolution is that it biffs out the way, and you talk about this in your book as well, it biffs out the way a whole lot of stories that we've become very attached to in terms of creation myths. You know, we all need creation myths, and there's sad bastard old Darwin comes along and blows those creation myths out the water. Do you feel sad about that?
I guess I don't, because it has an element of creation myth as well. I mean, yeah, of course, we love stories about where we came from. And one of the reasons we love them is that they are stories. One of the things we love about them is actually the emotional stuff we throw in. So I think it's broadened the palette. It's given people another really exciting story to rip into. Now, this story has a certain advantage, which is that it is melded with a scientific model which is both powerful and predictive and, you know, technologically useful. So you not only get the story, but with that story, sort of, you know, two for the price of one. Mm. You also get a way into thinking about something quite abstract, which is the beginning of, you know, genetics and so forth, and that whole sort of science thing.
I think science is sufficiently a story for you? Is that your conclusion?
No. I think all of us then have to throw a whole heap of story stuff on top of that, because the exciting thing about where did I come from story is somehow linked to who am I, what does it mean to be human, and all that big sort of stuff. Now, that stuff you've got to throw on top of your model. You've got to go hunting for that. You know,
the key thing is that it's evidence-based, surely. I mean, we as scientists use, we actually describe our work in terms of stories, Kim. I go to a conference and I give a story.
And in fact, you start off your book with the creation myth of the Maori, don't you?
That's right, in the preface, that's what you talk about.
And in fact, when you look at it from a scientific point of view, it's not that far from the truth, is it? That's roughly what sort of happened.
It is.
You're indulging me now.
End of story. No.
You are. You're indulging me now. When Paul Callaghan and I used to talk, the joke was that I would say, yes, but how? What would prove to you that this is all nonsense? And he would quote Hal Dane as saying, the discovery of a fossilized Precambrian rabbit, right? Hmm. Do you ever think, oh, my God, one day I'm going to discover the, you know, equivalent of a fossil?
I do. My father was a paleontologist at the University of Otago, and I remember getting embroiled in Bruce Cathy's ideas about extraterrestrial spacecraft visiting New Zealand. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
And I used to say, you know, read it. It's fantastic. It's very compelling. And he said, he just made one point. He said, nobody has yet found a fossil spacecraft. He's right.
However,
it's possible, isn't it?
Well,
it
is, yeah, possible. Except that nobody has yet found a fossilized lots of things.
No, that's right.
As a scientist, that doesn't dent your view of the veracity of evolution.
Well, I think you're up against one of the limitations of science, which is that we can only really deal, science will only embrace what we can see, what we can observe. So science is not very good at presenting fantasy, stuff that we humans can think up. But, I think that's the biggest difference between the arts and the sciences, actually. Where in science, we will only make a statement if we can demonstrate through repetition that something happens again and again and again. Repetition is key to the scientific method.
Although Bernard looked at the scientific method quite closely in terms of going through the various philosophical attitudes to it. Did you find that satisfactory?
It's satisfactory within its realm. I absolutely agree with you. Science deals with the things you can measure. Because, as you say, you need to be able to demonstrate. What can you demonstrate?
It just doesn't deal with the negative, with stuff that doesn't
exist.
So
it deals with things you can observe, but not only observe, measure, not only observe, but agree on the type of measurement. So you need everybody able to come to the table and say, this is what we mean when we talk about that term. This is how we will measure it. This is how we will calibrate and so forth. What's that convincing for? That's tremendously convincing for building data models and tremendously convincing for creating machines of prediction. You and I as human beings want to know a lot of other stuff. We want to know stuff about meaning, purpose, why we bother getting out of bed in the morning, what it means to be human. We want all that stuff. Now, clearly science won't take us there because none of those things I've just spoken of have the measurable component or the agreed measurable component. There's a reason why we still argue about what caused World War I, you know. And in essence, it's got something to do with the fact that so much of that is about story, about motivation. It's about moral story as well. It's about, you know, those overarching sort of themes. So was I convinced? Yeah, of course, I'm convinced by science in terms of what it does, and hugely cautious of people who would ask science to do more, I guess.
The gorilla that we may as well talk about in the front room is the whole science-religion split. And I don't think you go there, Hamish, but it's an undercurrent throughout if you're talking about the age of New Zealand. Obviously, you're going to be thinking about, you know, why didn't it happen 6,500 years ago like it says in the Bible? And both of you were raised, I think you were raised as a Catholic and you were raised as an Anglican and toyed with Catholicism for a while to find out whether it could accommodate you. Do you think that the way the world works is that there's religion and then science comes along with a big wave of activity and gives people enough answers, and then it goes too far, overreaches itself, and gives us uncertainty, and then religion hops in there?
Well, can I jump in? I don't I think Bernard has a different view of this to what I was talking about and looking for Tao, in that I think religion is essentially a way of life. It's a way of understanding the world.
It's
a story, yeah. But I think maybe I'm misinterpreting it. You seem to be saying that stories are all equally valuable to us all. Whereas I think there are differences in the science story because of the scientific methodology, and it comes down to, you know, this question of what is knowing. And so I think that from the point of view of science and evolution versus the religious story, they're quite incompatible on one level. But then you reach another level where neither religion nor science can really adequately answer big questions about the universe, you know, where the universe came from and things. So, you know, I actually think that the science story and the religious, it's not a case of religion and science jumping each other. I think that religion has to accommodate the science story if it's going to have some sort of validity.
Not vice versa.
I don't think so, no. Yeah.
I think it does still come down to understanding the boundaries of where science can and can't go. So the religious tradition, one of the religious traditions prior to evolution, was certainly a religious tradition that was where the expert was called upon to explain, if you like, every aspect of human life, both, you know, the moral, the aesthetic, and the predictive, the physical. And quite clearly, scientific, and we're not necessarily talking of religion here, because you can go back to Newton or Galileo or whatever, you've got loads of examples of this, blew the physical model out of the water. I said, if you as a religion want to cling to things like, you know, Earth at the center of the universe, if you want to cling to things like the perfect stars in the heavens, if you want to cling to things like a very quick creation, you're in all sorts, tens of different sorts of trouble, because you're not having to explain to people that the predictions your model makes are actually quite different to the predictions our model makes, and our model predictions are damn sight more accurate, and they enable all sorts of technology. But that is the physical. That doesn't touch the aesthetic. It doesn't touch the ethical. And so, of course, there is still a huge room for the religious story. Because where else do we actually get... You know, a really lovely example is biology tells us so much about what animals are and how we too are animals. But it doesn't tell us whether it's okay to lop the top of the head of a monkey and eat its brains. It doesn't tell us if that's okay or not. Loads of people have opinions on that. And
that's
all
not religion, though. That's ethics.
There it is. But again, I mean, I'd use the term religion really, really broadly, because otherwise you do is you do the Dawkins thing and say, I'm going to call religion this really weird little fundamentalist nut stuff. And then I'll show why it's nuts. Well, clearly it is. If you define
you
it as
nuts. You
think
that was a straw?
Yeah,
a
I think
straw
absolutely
priest,
so. But if you say, well, religion is actually, in the end, just everything all of us carry, which is how the hell do I answer the aesthetic and the ethical? And we all have models for that. They all come from somewhere. None of them come from science.
Well, I disagree with that. Good. I think that that religion, as you said, has to accommodate those scientific views. Like, I mean, if you say the Earth has been created in 6 days, you're clearly not consistent with the evidence. Now, whether you chop a monkey's head off or whatever, that I don't think that sort of religion is incompatible at all with a scientific belief. But if your religion is telling you something about a creation story, then, as I said, religion has to be able to accommodate the facts.
Oh, absolutely. No, I disagree on that for one moment. Yeah. And as we find out things about monkey consciousness or experience of pain or whatever, you'll take that into account as you make your decision on, you know.
I want to get back to Dawkins, because I suspect that you're going to say that he's an example of extremism.
For me?
Yeah.
The thing, I mean, we were just talking about it before, what a wonderful communicator, you know, in terms of the person who most allowed me as a layperson to understand evolution, he's
sure.
right up there. Take his last book, the God Something of Delusion. Yeah, it felt like a work of fundamentalism to me, which was a great shame. But it was sort of weird. One is, oh, there goes the hero crumbling, but also it's an attack on fundamentalism.
Yeah, but he's part of a wave, you know, and this is what I meant when the question, you know, we're going science, religion, science, religion, science, religion, and now science has set itself up and religion is being condemned, and I'm wondering whether it's just another phase we're going through. Can I just ask Lloyd, really, and also Hamish, you know, when Darwin found fossil shells 3 6,000 metres high in the Andes. Why didn't he think, given where he came from, and he was trained to be a clergyman, and he went back and he hadn't eschewed God, why didn't he think, oh, okay, great flood?
Well, in fact, Fitzroy, who was travelling with him, thought exactly that and told him that. You know, Fitzroy explained things like that through the flood.
Yeah.
But Darwin, it wasn't one single thing for Darwin where he thought, ah, eureka, you know, God doesn't exist and evolution does. It was not like that. It was just a slow accumulation of evidence. So he found, for example, fossils of large animals that no longer existed in South America. And he recognized that not only were they very old, but that they had relationships with the current animals in South America. But they were smaller. And so he started to think, well, maybe the animals came down from North America and started to think about the levels of the water, the sea level rising, separating South America from North America. And all those things, and Hamish is probably much better to answer this, those geological processes are very slow. But all those bits of evidence he put into his head and his notebooks and took back to England and dwelt on it.
And I suppose the underlying theory that he had was that everything is mutable, life is mutable, and the Earth that we always thought was, you know, relatively fixed is mutable. And you've been to places where he was and discovered that firsthand, haven't you?
I have. I was very fortunate. Kim, in 1982, I was 1992, I was with the University of Oxford expedition to the Andes, in Bolivia in particular, and subsequently, I've been back there. What we were exploring or addressing, talk about a big question, when did South America become high and when did it become bent? Those are the two questions we were addressing. And it's true, as you come down from Peru down to Chile, it's bent. Mm. Now, when did it bend? You know, and if you go up into the Altiplano, there are fossil forest tree stumps which relate to plants that only exist today at sea level. Anyway, that's an aside. I went to
there are lots and lots of asides. If you find any of these asides interesting, please direct us back to them with a question, because I'm having trouble keeping all these asides in my head and we haven't got enough time.
Near Mendoza in Argentina, there is a fossil forest with tree stumps preserved in situ, and Darwin correctly identified these as fossil Araucarian, so they're relatives of the kauri. Just on the basis of the scale, the nature of the bark, the way it's scaly, and one or two other attributes, and he was bang on. He just got the age wrong. He thought they were tertiary, that is less than 65 million, whereas in fact they're Triassic. They're more like somewhere between 250 and 200 million.
Gosh, that was a bridge too far for him, was it?
Well, nobody really had a real handle on any absolute age at that time, Kim. That was to come, you know, it wasn't until the 1920s, really. Mm. Now, the other locality that I've been to is Quiriquina Island, which is near Concepcion off the coast of Chile. Now, he was in 1835, was it?
I think it was earlier.
Or was it 1830? Might have been 1830. He was at sea. There was the Beagle. And they, unbeknownst to them, they rowed out a tsunami. And subsequently, they landed at Concepcion, discovered that the whole town had been raised by this enormous wave. And he visited this island, Quiriquina, and observed debris tossed several hundred meters up onto this island. And from that, he became aware that there had been an earthquake. They'd just experienced a big wave, or a wave of some sort at sea. And then they saw the aftermath. Darwin was fortunate, in my opinion, geologically, because he happened to be in South America, was more or less witness to a major earthquake with attendant tsunami, and he made the deduction that if you can get the land to leap, as it were, 1 or 2 meters into the air with an earthquake attendant, and you just got one of those every few years, then surely you could elevate South America in no time. Mm.
Actually, he did actually experience the earthquake there, because there's a lovely piece in his diary where he's writing back, because he was lying in a forest with his manservant. Is it Covington, I think? And he said something like, the earth moved for him. So
Well, he also got to see a volcano erupting. So I say that he was fortunate, geologically, to see two of the Earth's crustal processes right there.
How pivotal do you think that was to him? Because one of my questions was, do you think that if he'd never left Britain, if he'd never gone off on the HMS Beagle for 5 years, would he have written on the origin of species? Would he have evolved the theory? Could he have done it sitting at home?
No, is the answer.
Yeah, I personally think no.
Would have it mattered in terms of what Wallace published, or was that significantly lacking something?
No, I think what you're referring to is the fact that Alfred Russel Wallace came up with the same, exactly the same theory.
Why doesn't anybody remember poor Alfred then?
It's a sad thing, really.
It's a sad thing.
But the truth was that Darwin deserved to get the precedence because he had actually written down the whole, and in fact written a 200-page manuscript.
That's the difference.
16 years before Wallace came up with it. It's just that Darwin held back because he knew that his ideas were controversial, they were going to cause problems, and there were one or two things he wasn't sure about. So he did hang back. But Wallace actually came up with the exact thing. So to answer your question, it was the same theory.
Yeah, it would have been, who knows, it would have been fascinating, wouldn't it, if that was down.
Is that just weird synchronicity? Or was there something in the air, or had something happened to set them both off on the same track?
Oh, I think it's just time and place, you know, that the way your understanding of the world is developing. And it's just like you get multiple discoveries of the same things now, you know, about various things. And, you know, this idea that the Earth had that antiquity that was really something that only came about because of the contemporaries, not Darwin, but the contemporaries he had. So you have to sit him in some sort of milieu of science and knowledge and so forth. And I think it was just Wallace came up with the exact same idea. In fact, Darwin thought that was it. You know, he thought, oh, well, he's got the precedence. And it was Darwin's friends that said, no, you must jointly publish his work. Because the irony was Wallace sent Darwin his manuscript to read at the Linnaean Society.
So sweet.
Yeah.
Wasn't he?
Yeah.
I was thinking, Hamish, talking about the Great Flood, I was thinking about your theory. You've got a Great Flood theory.
Yes, and what I'm advocating in my book is that the whole of New Zealand may have been submerged 23 million years ago. Now, I can't prove it, but on the basis of what we know geologically, it is acceptable, logically, to entertain this idea.
So you mean, scientifically speaking, this is a hypothesis at this point?
That's right, yeah.
Which is up to be proven or disproven?
Yep.
As time goes by?
Yep. I think that's right. I actually think of science as being made up of ideas that have been refuted and ideas that have yet to be refuted.
So why have you come up with this idea?
Well, this is, it's been...
That is against the grain, actually, because it's not what most people have thought.
Yes, but it's only out of ignorance.
Of course.
But
they await elucidation. No, yeah, go on.
The thing is that as a result of some research we were doing in the Chathams, we started asking the question, well, how old are these extensive flat surfaces in the landscape? I'm talking about mainland New Zealand now. And we started looking in detail, and we really came up with quite a different picture from what we'd all learnt at university. And it's the unravelling, unpackaging, so to speak, of our understanding of the origin of flat surfaces, such as the Pini Plain in Otago, which we all learned was an old land surface. You look in detail and you can actually pick out the old land surface, and there superimposed on top of it is a surface that has been cut by the sea. So quite different. And the old Pini Plain is an old land surface, which is just formed as a function of consequential erosion. If you look in detail, what you see is that surface actually has a topography. Exactly what you'd expect. Our land surface is not flat. But when you see this geomorphic and regional flat surface in the topography, what you're looking at is quite a different entity, and it's been through the wave zone at least twice, in relation to New Zealand sinking and then rising.
And why can't you prove that?
Because of erosion. So I appeal to, for instance, the widespread presence of limestone between 20 and 30 million years old. I argue that it may have formed a complete sheet. Limestone being a biogenic sediment, you know, it's entirely made up of the remains of skeletal remains of marine organisms. There is not, quite literally, not a drop of sand in it. And you need sand relates to a terrigenous or land source, you see.
Yeah. Sorry, Lord, you were going to say.
So the point is that this limestone sheet is not a sheet.
No.
It's eroded all over the show.
Okay.
So we're then left with modelling. We can only... And other evidence, geological evidence, to play with.
Why is it so contentious?
It's contentious because the biological world find it difficult to accept that the ancestors of our modern-day native plants and plants and animals have got here within the last 20-odd million. So they would rather... The mantra was that all of New Zealand's animals...
Got here or developed here.
They all got here as a consequence of... as a cargo directly derived from Gondwana land. We broke away about 85 million years ago.
Yeah.
So what's novel in this idea is we're just saying... look, we actually have to entertain this idea of total submergence. We have to take it seriously because the geological evidence does not actually tell us that there was land here.
Do you think it's only a question of time before this is either proven or disproven?
Well, a lot of
so what?
The geologists say, look, the biologists are going to sort this out for us, and the biologists say, oh no, the geologists are going to sort it out. And I'm not sure what's going to happen. My feeling is that biology cannot sort it out for us.
Really?
So we're just left with the geological story, which is never going to be complete.
No.
So I think we may never know. But on balance, the majority of molecular biological evidence suggests that most of New Zealand's native flora has got here in the last 20 million. So that tends to support idea.
Well, I was just—I can't even say the word terrigenous, let alone know what it means. So I'm not going to get involved in a debate.
Land.
Yeah, okay. I'm not going to debate about it. But I just thought that when you were saying this, and I've read your book and so forth. I mean, that's the marvelous thing about the science story is that it seems to me, whether it's refuted or not, your idea, that's the thing about science. It's sort of self-correcting, and you move closer to a truth. And isn't that the difference with the other stories you have? Like, you have the science stories and the other stories you talk about, but the other stories are not self-correcting, are they?
Can I interrupt and ask you to explain something which I've never quite grasped?
Okay.
Because it seems to go to Lloyd's point, and Karl Popper said it, science has to be falsifiable.
Yeah, okay. Do you want me to explain that?
Yeah.
And then explain the word truth? Okay, sure. I can't do both those things. You can probably guess which I can't do. Falsifiability is fairly easy to think about. If you hold a theory and you can imagine the piece of evidence that would make you throw that theory away and other people could agree, that piece of evidence is going to blow this out of the water. Mm-hmm. That's what we mean when we say something is falsifiable.
The peak Cambrian fossilised rabbit.
Yeah. So it'd be very simple. You know, you've got, in a mathematical terms, you've got a sequence of three numbers and you say, I think what's happening here is they're doubling, we're adding one each time. I think, but I can think of two other possibilities. Mm. If the next number's 11, then I can't be right. You know, if we can find out what the next one is, damn, I have to go back and find a new explanation for my pattern. So Popper said that the interesting thing about science, and exactly what you talked about, is there's two aspects here. One's the progressive nature. So I sort of often say, you know, talking to kids the other day, if you went back to the year 1600 and you were to go back with what you know about science now, the scientists, if you like, of the day, the Galileo or whoever you happen to talk to, there's quite a lot you, even probably I, with no real science background, could tell him that would fascinate him. There's been a whole heap of things that have happened in the next 400 years that feel progressive. Mm. And on the back of that, we've got progressive technology. Mm. If I was to walk as a drama teacher into the globe and say, William, slow down, I just need to tell you some things have happened in drama in the last 400 years, and Hamlet's a bit of shit now, you know. I would have a lot less basis for saying that. So the arts, other forms of knowledge, I believe, and some people argue vigorously against this, I've had these arguments, but I do believe that notion that the progressiveness of science is really interesting, and I think that is, we do have to answer to that. The idea that it approaches truth, however, requires a definition of truth. And a number of people have challenged that, and the challenge really comes from the philosopher Hume, who said that what you've got with science is actually a model that just works. Mm. We can't assume it'll work tomorrow. We just assume it's worked up to now. So we really shouldn't call it truthful. We should just say it's really damned useful. It may not say something deep about the way the world really is. After all, we are collecting data, filtering it through our mind, which apparently is also a biologically evolved thing. There's no reason why the mind will have evolved to work out the truth of the world. It's much more likely it's evolved to make us effective in this world. And they can be quite different things. The way I perceive things visually compared to how a cat perceives things, and how, who knows what it's like to just perceive through hearing like a bat, you know, that they are solutions to help us survive, interact, do the things we need to. Seems to me extremely unlikely the human brain has evolved in order to understand the truth of the world. Mm-hmm. There's no reason at all to expect that the scientific model is taking us closer to a deep truth about what the world is, what it's made of, whether time exists, those sorts of things. Why would we be equipped with them? All we actually have is a model that we know is very good at generating prediction and generating agreement when a point is falsified, which seems to me to be the reason why it progresses. Because everyone can come along and go, this model's looking good, really good. It made a wacko prediction, which turns out to be true. Everybody's on board, let's work on it. Whereas the historians, as I say, are still arguing about what caused World War I, you know. There's more to be gained from working against each other.
So, okay, you know. So why don't you think that science offers the truth?
Because if you take a definition of the truth that is something other than usefulness...
Yes.
...then what is that definition, you know? And now you're going back to sort of Plato, this idea that there's this overarching, and a lot of the, you know, the Christian religion picked up on that, this overarching real world. You know, there's a God, or there's another dimension, or there's... Well, who the hell knows? And we don't. I don't think we have any technique for knowing that whatsoever. What we have is the way our brain, puny as it is, processes data. That's what we've got. And these really wonderful little models for dealing with that processing. Some of those models are stories. We process in real time things about jealousy, about motivation as a classic example. We use the model of other human beings' motivation in order to understand what they're up to. Mm. It's incredibly efficient. It may be nonsense. We tell ourselves fantastic stories about our own motivation. You know, because when I was 7, someone took my teddy bear, I had an anger problem, I dealt with that. Well, who knows? Not really, but we like the story. So motivation stories are incredibly efficient. Mathematical models, look, a lot of science has been dragged by mathematical discovery. Every time you get, you know, fractals come along, and suddenly you get a new way of modelling the world, which opens up a new form of very, very powerful prediction. And so science, at times, has actually lurched behind mathematical discovery. So a lot of the statistical work has dragged modern genetics.
But when
work.
You say it's lurched behind, that implies that you're heading somewhere. Well, it implies at least... You used the word before when you said you were testing something and something proved to be... Or shown to be true. So
there's an idea of progress going on.
I think it's a definition of what truth is that's being
argued
about.
Well, Popper had this
it.
Idea and he said, I can't say for sure something is true. But once I've falsified it, I can say for sure it's not true.
Yep.
Now, I think he's wrong in that. And the reason he's wrong in that is that falsification... here's the example. You believe that all horses are brown, and then one day you see a black horse. You now are no longer allowed to believe in a world where all horses are brown. That's his classic example.
Swans, I think, wasn't
and
it?
Swans gets used in all the rest of it. Now, here's your problem. Let's say the brown horse you saw was the last brown horse in the world, and it just died. Now you're back to a world where all horses are black, but sadly you falsified a world in which all horses are black. So the problem was, in doing that, he was actually assuming inductive principles, which again are useful, but they're just an assumption. So you can't say, because I've falsified it, I know forever it's wrong.
At this point, and I dare say we could argue about this forever, at this point I'm going to insert one of the quotes that you use from David Hume, which I think is what you're talking about now.
Maybe.
And he said that our thinking needed to retain a certain looseness to stop the possible shrinking to the size of the actual. Is that fair enough? It's nice, isn't
it? It's a lovely quote, isn't
it? It's very nice.
It's fantastic. I love it. Let's leave it at that. But yes.
Well, yeah.
Kim, I've discovered something with my book. It's engendered a bewildering array of responses, shall we say. And it falls into two camps. I don't believe that. That's one camp. And the other camp says, I don't think that.
Because, ..
Well, you see the difference? I'm fascinated.
You've got no one that agrees with you, Hamish?
Sure.
But you're open to arguments, are you? Well, oh, there was a pause, ladies and gentlemen. You know, if somebody comes along and says,
Kim, I would say it's unassailable logically.
At this particular moment in time. You know, it's like 100 years ago, I was just reading this article, 100 years ago, everybody thought that the universe was fixed and that our galaxy was the only one around, you know?
That's right.
And that seemed unassailable. Yeah. So we know more now, we know more now. Every time we know more, we then get to know less, though. That's the problem,
isn't it? But this is where I have difficulty with Bernard, because you would seem to be saying, we don't actually know that.
I know.
Well, it depends on what you want to mean by no. Now, here's what I reckon. Just, oh, no. Okay. Spot the
Somebody put their hand up quickly.
But I'll just have a crack at this. That is why I think it is so important to distinguish between predictive, modelled knowledge, the stuff you're talking about, and when we say we know this, when I say I know there are more people living in Tokyo than Ekitahuna, I'm using exactly that colloquial, and it's useful to use the word know for that. The history of science suggests to us, right from the first clashes, you know, in the 1700s and then again with Darwin and so forth with the church, that science is always tempted to taking, I know that, predictive, measurable stuff, and trying to apply it to the aesthetic and the ethical. It's just a temptation we have. Richard Dawkins is so tempted by this that he's changed the sort of things he writes about. It's a huge trap, it's always there. So we must be reminded of the difference between predictive knowledge and ethical knowledge and aesthetic knowledge. They are different things, and we need all three of them to make sense of anything.
Hands up for any questions in the audience, because I've just realised what the time is, and there is a microphone travelling around if you have any questions to put.
We have a question. Yes, a question for Bernard. I'd like to challenge the idea that aesthetics is somehow... There's a boundary between that field and science. A finding about 3 years ago found that elderly classical music lovers who developed Alzheimer's became increasingly fond of heavy metal. Now, findings like that are liable to intrude on the stories from your realm and prove many of them wrong, are they not?
I guess what I was getting at with aesthetics, and I was using the term sloppily for sure, was actually that sense of meaning. Now, what do I make in terms of sense of life? Now, interestingly, of course, that can have a physical element. You're quite right. I mean, brain surgeons have talked about very weird situations. Apparently, often they keep the patient conscious during brain surgery for the very simple reason they do need to be able to ask questions about what's this doing. So, and they're careful not to lop off stuff that matters. That sounds bizarre, but I'm told that's true. And there are recorded cases of someone pushing a particular part of the brain, and the person saying, wow, that's really cool, I just heard that song again. Do it again, I love that song. So that when I talk about aesthetics, that sense of meaning, absolutely there is a link between that and the physical world. Now there's the great last mystery in so many ways, the link between the physical brain and consciousness, to which of course I have no solution, and neither does anybody else yet. So yes, there is something very weird and interesting going on there. I talk blithely about this thing called meaning, and of course all that construction may be physical, but equally our understanding of physical is intellectually constructed, so it's circular at the moment.
I wanted to talk about evolutionary psychology just for a moment, because it strikes me that you've talked about that as being an example of the kind of extremism that evolution gets us into, like everybody must be dictated by evolution and therefore, you know, women are this and men are in their caves and blah, blah, blah. Is this an area which cannot be falsified? Is that the problem with it?
No, it's a classic case of you can do it very well and do it very badly. One of the things that people often miss about falsification is the thing that falsifies shouldn't be existing evidence. You shouldn't say, I reckon if the sun comes up in the east tomorrow, that'll clinch it for me. Because all models of the world have the sun coming up in the east tomorrow. We already knew that. So the evidence that's most compelling is the evidence that's novel. So, you know, the sort of iconic example is often used with Einstein and the ability of mass to bend light, which no one had picked. And then when he said, I think my model suggests that, we wait for an eclipse and have a look at, you know, the relative apparent position of stars, and good Lord, it happens, everyone's very, very impressed. If you're talking about evolutionary psychology and saying, I've got this theory that back in the cave days, you know, men who got lost, right, they weren't allowed to admit they were lost because then other people would know they were strangers on the territory and they'd kill them. So that's why men don't ask for directions anymore. That's a really cool story. And it's definitely a story at this stage. If you could say, therefore, I predict that if we set up a certain type of experiment, men will behave in a way that no one's expected them to. And that turns out, and it's consistent, that's nice testing. But if you say, I therefore predict men won't much like asking for directions, that's cheating. Because you already knew that, it's how you created your story. You can't then use the same evidence to validate your story. Now, evolutionary psychology, at its pop level, does that all the time.
Men are from Mars and...
Yeah, women are apparently, you know, just want one or two sexual mates. Men want lots. Why do we, you know, and this is because of something to do with the way, you know, breeding cycles. Well, that's cool, but what's your evidence going to be? It can't just be the existing social stereotype.
Well, no, okay.
I have actually got an answer to that question, though.
Thank you.
I asked somebody in this realm, I said, you know, when is the optimum time for women to mate? You know, we blokes can't tell. And without
it's
hesitation...
It's not what I heard.
Without hesitation, she said, when on holiday.
Do you share Bernard's concern that evolution is used to explain too much?
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree more with Bernard about this idea of canonical evidence, that you cannot use existing, what you know of the world as predictive evidence. It's coming up with things that you didn't know and being able to predict them. So I agree with you about the methodology, and I would take it much further than just evolutionary psychology. I think if you just look at biology generally, most biologists, although they subscribe to the Darwin's notion of evolution by natural selection, many of them are very, very loose in the way they apply it. So there's good science and there's bad science. And there's a sort of saying in the halls of biology of people making up just-so stories, because Darwin's theory is so dogmatic now. Like, it's so ingrained in the scientists and their lexicon that you can always come up with some adaptation, some reason why a particular trait is going to be beneficial to the animal. And the trouble with evolution is that it doesn't act on individual traits. What's preserved is the whole organism, and the whole organism goes on to reproduce and so forth. And whether it has a longer neck or, you know, a shiny breast or whatever, you've got to tease that out, and because it's a big sum game. It's all the things about it affected whether it survived or reproduced.
But aren't you guilty of that?
I'm sure.
In your book, you talk about rats, and if they eat a... How does it go? If they get something or other, it makes them less afraid of cats.
Oh, okay. So
don't you look at me blankly like that.
I was going to bluff it, but that's part of the book you read, Dan.
Yeah. You know, so you go.
It's a neat little story about the
fact. Did you make that up?
No, I didn't. I pulled it out of a science journal. I loved it so much I put it in there. The good news is I was saying that most knowledge is story, so you forgive me. But isn't it a fantastic story?
It's a fantastic story.
It is about a particular bacteria which has the ability, and now people are claiming, and you'll be able to help me out on this, I'm sure, that has the ability to change human moods too. There are even arguments that it's having an effect on human psychology.
Makes us less afraid of cats.
Less afraid of cats. Well, in fact, it changes risk-taking behaviour. Now, because the particular bacteria in its life cycle needs to end up in the stomach of the cat, it's a damn good way to get there. But there is a whole, am I not right, there's a whole brand of various bacteria that do things like affect insects and encourage them to the end of grass.
So why isn't that evolutionary explanation oversimplified?
It may well be hugely oversimplified.
Do you think?
And when you say things like fear of cats as opposed to risk taking, you are cheating. You know, you're being hugely seduced by story at that level.
Yep. Yeah,
that's a really good example of that seduction. Yeah.
But there is quite a lot of evidence for things like mollusks and things that live in shells and that, having parasites that cause them to make themselves vulnerable to predators, because that's how the parasite reproduces. Mm. It goes through its cycle.
But so I think this is the problem that people have with Darwin and evolution, isn't it? That eventually you start talking about some kind of foresight or some kind of intention. Do you know what I mean? Because it seems to fit so perfectly. This is a kind of anthropic principle, I suppose, isn't it? Do you think?
Well, that is the problem. I mean, that's the problem with science. Well, not so much science, but evolution and Darwinism and the religious view that when an animal fits so perfectly within its environment...
Could never be chance.
You don't know whether it came about through evolution or it came about through some sort of creative force or something. And it's really where you find the anomalies. Like Gould writes about the panda's thumb and things like that, that they tell you more about the process of evolution than does the perfect fit of the animal.
Mm. When you talk about evolution, often we think about colors of plumes and the length of necks and physical attributes. But what about the psychological, social, behavioral aspects? Are we seeing a part of this evolution going on?
Some people have certainly thrown the idea out that ideas have characteristics that make them appear like reproductive units.
Memes.
And so the memes is the phrase that was coined. And I think Popper talked about this before Dawkins picked it up, so the early 70s. And there was that fascinating idea that does evolution give you an interesting model for thinking about the way ideas themselves, because ideas form people and they form things like cities and technology and so forth. Religious ideas and so forth. I don't think that that aspect of it is a tight enough model to do things like making predictions. It's just a cute way of looking at whether we're biologically reproducing. Someone else should answer. Reproducing, good God, what a phrase. Evolving.
You want me to answer?
Mm. Go on.
Okay.
Go on.
I think we should not lose sight of the fact that we are subject still to evolution and to natural selection, but that we've got the ability to change ourselves in a way that still will be subject to the same principles of evolution, natural selection, but we've got an ability to do that over and above the natural processes that are happening as well. I mean,
we haven't made ourselves immune from it.
Oh, hell no. And we will, we are a really young species. I mean, you know, we have this consciousness to think about ourselves and our place in the world, but we shouldn't get too cocky because, you know, we've been around for maybe 5-6 million years. You know, that's a pretty short lifespan when you know the Earth the way you know it in terms of animals. And who's to say we're going to be around for another 5 million or even another 500?
Is that the sense that you get, Hamish, when you're fossil king with your fossils? That we're a mere, you know, glimmer across the expanse of the universe?
Yes, I do. I think it's amazing that we really cannot track our ancestry back more than about 5 million. I think one thing that geology and science has given us, around this whole question, is a time frame that we just didn't have a century ago. And that time frame, it's our ability to date things is getting better and better and better. And so I see two things that we haven't talked about at all, but which can be very confusing to the public, is indeed the time frame within which things happen, such as evolution, and also the scale. We get conflicting messages in the media, for instance, with respect to climate change. A correlation is made, and you look in detail, and the correlation is actually, they're comparing something at one scale with something at another scale. And it's really important to get these things clear in our minds.
And what was the other thing?
The time frame and scale.
Oh, okay.
Time and scale.
So you're not, just for the record, you're not saying that global warming is a scientific misunderstanding?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I think that there is a popular misunderstanding because the science world is flat out trying to determine, A, what causes global warming and... What are the feedback mechanisms? We don't think we've got the full picture yet.
Do you think that
it's happening? Don't get me wrong.
Yeah,
it is happening.
Do you think that the urgency of the situation has caused some science not to have been carried out as rigorously as it might have been.
Yeah, I think that's true. Science is a very human activity, and it gets published because it's got past an editor and a couple of referees.
Mm.
It's as simple as that.
Because it might not self-correct in time before people charge off down the wrong
road. I mean, Lloyd made the point that there's good science and there's bad science. Ah. And the scientific world, we're endlessly conscious of this. And it's very, very embarrassing when something gets published. And frankly, it's shown next week to be incorrect.
Don't you think that's good, though? It's shown to be incorrect.
Well, this is... It is. That's
the point.
That's very good. You're absolutely right. But isn't it a mistake to publish it in the first place?
Well, how will you know? I mean, you can publish things in good faith. You might not know that it's incorrect. Nothing can be...
Well, it's a weird business.
You know.
The scientific world addresses an awful lot of questions. I mean, that's what it's doing all the time. It's addressing questions. Now, if you get a negative result, invariably it's not published.
Yeah.
I've worked, for instance, I'll give you an example. I've worked with a Japanese group looking at paleomagnetic... record of old rocks in New Zealand, and this man sampled over a period of 8 years and didn't get a sensible result. And I said, surely you've got to publish this, otherwise somebody else will come along and do exactly the same. And he has published it. Isn't that great?
Thank God. And nobody's come along and said this is rubbish.
Exactly. But it won't stop people coming and having another go.
No.
It's really important, actually, that some other laboratory come and have a crack.
That's right.
But to my knowledge, he is the third person who's had a go. The other two didn't publish, and he didn't know that they'd had a go. You see what I mean?
Shades of Darwin and Alfred.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
So it is immensely important, if you're onto something, to write it down. Mm. There's no doubt about it.
Well, bear that in mind. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it. I hope you have too. Thank you to the authors.
Thank you.